Right, getting to the end of the Middle Ages, the last century we're getting into of the 14th century. Well, even before 14th century, we have Anne of Bohemia. In the late 14th century, was the eldest daughter of Emperor Charles IV of the Holy Roman Empire. Her brother was King Wenceslas of Bohemia, who was named after the subject of a famous Christmas carol. You read about good King Wenceslas, or you've sung about him. And so that was actually her brother, who was named after that subject, the famous. He is a great warrior and fighter. Anne was taught the truths of the scriptures from her youth. There were a number of faithful gospel preachers in Bohemia at that time. Bohemia is in the country of the Czech Republic now, including Konrad Strickner, Johann Melick, and Matthias Janowicz. Anne asked many probing questions concerning scriptural truth. Anne was described as a godly, intelligent young girl with an inquiring mind. She is renowned for her love of reading and for her possession of the scriptures in many languages. Her favorite books of the Bible were the four Gospels, which she constantly studied. Anne came to recognize the many errors prevailing in the Roman Catholic Church, and she persisted in praying for a return to biblical faithfulness, to the doctrine of the apostles, and to the purity of the early church. The traditional alliance of Bohemia with France was shattered by the joint defeat at the hands of the English at the Battle of Crecy, 1346. Then the papal schism further divided the Bohemians from their traditional allies, the French, because France supported the Pope Clement VII of Avignon, and King Wenceslas chose to support Pope Urban VI in Rome. As the English also allied with the French against the French Pope, the Bohemians came into alliance with the English for the first time. And so Battle of Crecy was a turning point in their history. And so the traditional alliance was shattered. As Richard II's father, Edward, the Black Prince, because he had black armor, died in 1376, and his grandfather, King Edward III, the following year, Richard II became King of England at age 10. Negotiations began to solidify the alliance between Bohemia and England by the marriage of Prince Anne to King Richard. Richard II's father was called the Black Prince because of his dark-colored armor, and he had won his spurs at the Battle of Crecy. Brave young man. In January 1382, when Richard II was only 15 years old and Anne was 16 years old, they were married at St. Stephen's Chapel at Westminster. Not too unusual at that stage, because the life expectancy is only about 30. I mean, at 15, you're middle-aged. Although their marriage had been arranged by diplomats, it appears to have been a good, loving, and positive partnership. And Anne was undoubtedly an excellent influence on Richard during their 12 years together. Reportedly, Queen Anne had been persuaded to accept the proposal because of positive reports that she had received of the Reformation work of Professor John Wycliffe of Oxford University. The Archbishop of York, Arundel, one of the most vitriolic enemies of Wycliffe's Reformation, was horrified to hear that this queen owned copies of the Gospels, which she avidly studied, sure sign of being a heretic. Professor John Wycliffe was delighted to learn of Anne's love for the Scriptures, and he publicly compared her to the biblical Mary, who sat at Jesus' feet, listening to what the Master had to say. For her part, Queen Anne protected Wycliffe from his many enemies and intervened on numerous occasions to protect him from prosecution and to save his life. For her part, Queen Anne protected him and she intervened on numerous occasions to save him. And here you can see Anna, the Queen here. And she's right next to John of Gaunt, who's raising a sword in defense of Wycliffe being attacked by his many, many enemies. At the encouragement of Queen Anne, Bohemian students came to Oxford to study under John Wycliffe, and many of these students carried back the Reformation writings and teachings of Wycliffe to Prague, to Bohemia, and throughout Central Europe. This is the Queen's personal emblem or shield, her crest. Many of Queen Anne's friends and servants became dedicated Christian believers. The common people of England came to love their queen, and her kindness and generosity to the poor was legendary. This is a picture of the queen kneeling in prayer with, and this would be presumably John the Baptist here, I think. And that presumably is her husband, the king. Who this one is in the middle, I am not sure. It's said that as many as 6,000 people were fed daily through her charity or benevolence. Students sponsored by Queen Anne were soon taking Reformation teachings as far afield as Lithuania, which then was a much bigger country containing a lot of what today would be considered Ukraine and Russia. Tragically, this bright and shining light was cut short on the 7th of June, 1394, as Anne died at age 27 from the plague. So actually, she was middle-aged at age 16. Her husband, King Richard II, was devastated, and the people of England deeply mourned her. Many of her Christian servants returned to Bohemia with the translations of the Gospels and the writings of John Wycliffe that had been so highly treasured by the Queen. This led to the conversion of Professor Jan Hus of Bohemia. It led to the birth of the Hussite movement and later the Moravians, who were the first to establish a mission station in South Africa at Carnarvon. From them, missionaries went out literally to ends of the earth and even to the Cape. And in fact, you can think of the prophecy of Jan Hus. You know, when Jan Hus was being burned at the stake, he made a prophecy. Jan Hus said, "My goose is cooked," which was a joke because the name Hus means goose in Bohemian. "My goose is cooked, but 100 years from now, a swan will arise whose voice you will not be able to silence." And 100 years later, along came Martin Luther, which is why there's a lot of swans in architecture of the Lutherans. Interestingly enough, when Martin Luther was ordained into the Catholic priesthood, he had to lie face down in a cruciform form in the front of Erfurt Cathedral. Now, that was standard. They still do it today. But, you know, they bury many bishops and famous people in the churches too. It just so happened that when Luther was ordained as a priest in the Catholic Church, he was lying face down over the tomb of the very bishop who had burned at the stake Jan Hus at the Council of Constance. And you can imagine when Jan Hus made this prophecy that 100 years from now, a swan will arise whose voice you'll not be able to silence. He might have said something like, "Over my dead body." And 100 years later, Martin Luther is ordained over the very grave, literally directly lying face down over the grave of this bishop. So God has a sense of humor. And Martin Luther launched a Reformation. That'll have to be for another day. I have definitely underestimated the amount of time needed for dealing with these 2,000 centuries. I think the last 5 centuries will have to be another day. In fact, it probably have to be several days. We could give a day just to the Reformation century of the 16th century. "These things command and teach. Let no one despise your youth, but be an example to the believers in word, in conduct, in love, in spirit, in faith, in purity. Till I come, give attention to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Do not neglect this gift that is in you, which was given to you by prophecy with the laying on of the hands of the eldership. Meditate on these things. Give yourselves entirely to them, that your progress may be evident to all. Take heed to yourself and to the doctrine. Continue in them, for in doing this, you will save both yourself and those who hear you." Major event, 1347, the plague, the bubonic plague, devastated all of Europe. The plague was found to have originated from lice on the rats that came off the ships from China that landed in Venice. And in 1347, all of the Mediterranean area had been affected and a third of the population died. Reached Germany the next year, 1348, on the other side of the Alps, and England, a third died there. And then all the way through to Russia, 1350, and basically something in the region of a third to, in some places, two-thirds of the population died of the plague. And the plague caused many people to come to Christ. Many, 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 such as John Wycliffe, were so brought to their knees in fear. So at the end of the 1300s, at the end of the 13th century, you can see the size of the Golden Horde, that's the Mongols, who wiped out something in the region of 12 million people. Notice the Monomotapa empires growing up in what today is Zimbabwe. You've got the Malian Empire, the Canaan Empire, Nubians and Ethiopians are still strongly Christian. You can see also the expansion of the Khanates, the sorts of Mongolian hordes, into India. The church, well, severe Christian decline throughout the whole of Asia, mostly Nestorian Christians, all these areas have been strongly Christian. So these dark areas, the strong red lines represent severe violent persecution. The thinner lines, persecution. And you can see there's persecution, of course, in Europe, England, Bohemia, northern Italy, for the Waldensians in particular, Egypt, all the way through to Nubia and what today would be Ethiopia, amongst the Christians in India as well. So there's severe persecution for Christians just about throughout the entire world. The main persecutors were, in fact, the Muslims, and the main martyrs were the Eastern Christians, including Assyrians and Coptics. 1415, Jan Hus burned at the stake. He was given an opportunity to renounce his teachings. He said, "I would not for a chapel full of gold recede from those teachings that I've taught my life. I will gladly seal with my blood that which I've taught in my life." When he is given another chance at the place where he is going to be burned outside of Constance, what was called the Devil's Ground, he said, "I would turn from the right to the wrong, but I will not turn from the truth to error." And so Jan Hus, his motto was "Truth conquers." His followers used the cup, the chalice, as a symbol, because he insisted that the people, the laity, must receive the elements of the Lord's Supper, both in the fruit of the vine and with the wafer. Because up till then, the whole idea is you only got the wafer, you didn't get a cup. Because what if you spill some of the blood of Christ? And so they reserved the cup only for the priests. And this is an emblem of the Hussites and the Moravians later, and the Brethren. And of course, Luther and other reformers followed this later. The Hussites resisted the papacy. They resisted six great crusades. You can see Veritas Venit, truth conquers. That's the Hussite motto. And to think that they inspired everyone from Count Nicholas von Zinzendorf, the Moravians, and George Schmidt, who planted the mission at Gnadendorf. 1453, Constantinople fell to the Muslim Turks, one of the most catastrophic events in the ancient world. The greatest city in the world, Constantinople, with the largest church in the world, St. Sophie, destroyed by Muslim Turks. While they pleaded for help from Europe, and the rest of Europe ignored their pleas for help. And so the Muslim Turks took the greatest city in the world. Just in St. Sophie alone, about 12,000 people were murdered that day. They had already been encircled for years. The Muslim Turks had already taken Bulgaria, Romania, Greece, and so on. And so Constantinople was hanging on a fingernail at the edge there. But the greatest city in the world, after 1,000 years of being a Christian kingdom, fell to the Muslim Turks. 29 May, 1453. Shortly after that, 1456, Johann Gutenberg produced the first printed book in history, the Bible, in Latin. We've actually got a page replica in the hallway of the Latin Vulgate Bible printed by Johannes Gutenberg. Johannes Gutenberg, the inventor of the printing press, voted the man of the millennium at the end of the 1999 because, of course, from a mass media point of view, he introduced the beginning of the information age. Without the printing press, well, we couldn't consider just about anything that we're doing right now anyway. So the inventor of the printing press, absolutely tremendous. And he was in the top 10 of everyone, but most voted him as number one, most important man of the millennium. Well, I can understand why the media would say that. But they didn't tell you what he printed. Among the number of blessings which we ought to praise God for is this invention, which enables the poorest to purchase libraries at a low price. Is it not great glory that volumes that used to cost 100 pieces of gold are now to be bought for 4, even less, and that the fruits of genius multiply over all the earth? So Gutenberg's invention of the printing press is rightly classified as one of the greatest events in the history of the world. The printing press prepared the way for the Reformation and the progress of modern science and literature. The printing press became an indispensable tool for the fulfillment of the Great Commission and development of universal education. Gutenberg's invention enabled our multiplied millions to discover for themselves great literature and, most importantly, the Word of God. Also, 1492, the liberation of Spain from Islamic occupation was completed with the liberation of Granada. And in 1492, Christopher Columbus sailed the ocean blue, discovered the New World, which became known as America. Not that he knew that. He thought he had gotten to the far coast of China. But Christopher Columbus is not much honored and appreciated and respected in America these days, but they should, because he went with a real desire to fulfill scriptural prophecies. He is inspired by prophecies that he'd be able to reach the far shores of China by sailing west, which was very interesting, get to the east by sailing west. He obviously understood things quite well, and he was motivated by fulfillment of biblical prophecies. What's also interesting is that he had a vision of getting gold from the New World to help finance a new crusade to liberate the Holy Land and the Eastern Empire from Islamic occupation. There's an excellent book that we've got in our library here by Colonel John Eidsmo on Columbus, Cortez, Golden God, something along that line. We're speaking about the Last Crusader as well, that he was in many ways a person who had a vision of crusade. Interesting to get about the 1400s. You've got 44 million people in the world in Europe. That's about 14% of the world's population. About 11 million people in 10%. South America, they're expecting about 19 million people and so on. North America, about 6.2. They would say 75 million in East Asia. So, interesting, they think there were only 31,000 people in all of Australasia at that stage. Obviously, the age of explorers, particularly in the 14th and 15th centuries, they sailed around the world and discovered new places. And very interesting how it worked out. Because if the Spanish had settled North America, Brazil would be there. If the Catholics had taken North America. Catholics went to South America. They liked the warmer climes. If the Catholics had settled Cape Town, which they could have, because Portugal and Spain were a century and a half ahead of Britain and Holland as great maritime powers. If we had been settled here in the Cape by the Portuguese Catholics, well, history would be very different. This might be one big Brazil, like Mozambique, Angola, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Botswana, all one big Portuguese-speaking Catholic country, much like Brazil is there. History would be very different if the Protestants had not settled North America and South Africa and Australia and New Zealand. History would be very different. And, of course, key elements in that comes up in 16th century, and that's in 1588, the defeats of the Spanish Armada. So, in the year 1500, this is roughly what's going on. They're just showing you where explorers have gone. But you can see the different empires of the world and the Ming Dynasty rising up and the Delhi Sultanate, that's a Muslim Sultanate, and what's going on in pre-Reformation world. The Inca Empire, the Aztec and the Mayan empires, sacrificing people and all of that. The church, well, church at the beginning of the Reformation era is mostly concentrated in Northern and Western Europe. The green shows the extent of Islam's effects and raids. Church is severely persecuted in its heartland of where it was founded. Persecutors are mostly Muslim. Martyrs are mostly Eastern. The great names of the Middle Ages, Boniface, the Venerable Bede, King Alfred the Great, Charlemagne or Charles the Great, first leader of the Holy Roman Empire, Peter Waldo, founder of the Waldensians, Bernard of Clairvaux, one of the great devotional works produced in all of history on loving God, written by Bernard of Clairvaux. Francis of Assisi, patron saint of animal welfare in many ways. He did missions to Muslims, a lot of brave things. John Wycliffe, Professor John Wycliffe, the morning star of the Reformation, and Jan Hus, professor of Prague University, reminds us that there was a time when the professors of universities were God-fearing, Bible-studying, agents of Reformation. There was a time when universities were hotbeds of Reformation, where people were scared to send their children to university because they'd get converted and get into the Bible and become radical reformers and evangelists. Boy, have times changed. We need to take universities back for Christ. Uni Veritas, one truth. The very name university testifies to its Christian origins. Uni Veritas, one truth. Pagans don't even believe in truth, let alone one truth. And so we should tell the pagans, you can have a diversity, you can have an aversity, you can have a polyversity, but a university should be Christian, by definition. So, on our reformationessay.org website, you'll find a range of good materials, including links to our slide share, which will include PowerPoints like this, these that we're doing. It'll include videos such as what we've been recording, and you also get, if you're interested in getting updates on what we do at the Reformation Society every Thursday night, getting a Reformation Society email. Our frontline website and email, we also send out regular updates on what happened on this day in Reformation history and things like that.